Comments and views expressed on The Kevin Smith Show are those of the people that make them and do not necessarily reflect the views of Kevin Smith, The Kevin Smith Show, or its affiliates or sponsors.
And welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Kevin Smith Show, whoever you are, wherever you may be around this beautiful planet. Thank you for being here at Talk Radio like nowhere else on Earth. It is the show where you matter. We're here because you have a right to know. Speaking of knowing, we published in the K-Files in last week's edition of our free weekly newsletter an update on Command Sergeant Major Norton, that still is the most current information that we have at this point. But if you are not subscribed to the K-Files, you, of course, did not get that update. And you need to be subscribed because, number one, it's free. Number two, there's no genius in being in the dark when light is available, free of charge. You can unsubscribe anytime you want to, and it only takes a few seconds to subscribe. You just click on my website, kevinsmithshow.com. Just click that big link right in the middle of your page there, in the middle of your screen that says K-Files, and you can subscribe. You'll get a confirmation email with a link in it to click to activate your subscription. Be sure you do that, because if you don't, then your subscription is not activated, and you don't get the K-Files, okay? So be sure you do that. Also, let me encourage you, if you've been listening to the show for a long time and you think, what is there in the members area that I could really be interested in? I mean, I get the show for free, right? Yeah, you do. Well, not really. Other people who are members are paying the expenses so you can listen for free. But what you get in the members area is a whole lot of stuff. You get your own profile page, friends page, blog page, photo gallery page where you can upload photos that are important and interesting to you. You get forums. You get our video galaxy. You get our chat room. You get a library of free ebooks. You get our archives, which are called K-Pods. And you also get to watch the show. And you get to, in the event you miss the show live, you can still watch it for the next 24 hours after we do the show because we capture it and upload it. So there's a whole lot there. And then we have some special broadcasts like we had this last weekend. About 4 hours of special broadcast just for our community of members in the members area. So what did that cost them for all of that? 23 cents a day. That's it. 23 cents a day. Now, look, one cup of coffee down at Starbucks would pay most of your monthly membership, maybe all of it. It's only $6.95 for the month. So we're not talking about giving up a cup of coffee a day. We're talking about giving up one cup of coffee in the month. Now, come on. Any argument that this is not worth it is not worth it. We hope you'll join us in the members area, and you can do it tonight. Just go to kevinsmithshow.com, click where it says join, and join. It's even a little bit cheaper if you go quarterly, and even a little bit cheaper yet if you go annually. We'll be back with my guest, Lynn Kasten, right after this. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening is Lynn Kasten. He is the author of a rather amazing book. This book is called The Secret History of Extraterrestrials, 312 Power Pack pages. Lynn, welcome to the Kevin Smith Show.
Thanks, Kevin. Nice to be here.
Lynn, let's begin with what is your background and what got you interested? How did you get into writing about UFOs and extraterrestrials?
Well, you know, I've been writing.
Well, Lynn, your audio is completely broken up. We cannot hear you.
Oh, really? Can you hear me now?
Yeah. Are you on a cordless phone?
No, I'm on a cell phone.
Okay, that's the problem. Okay, try it again.
Can you hear me now?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, you know, I've been writing articles for Atlantis Rising magazine for 14 years. Hello, Kevin?
We're listening.
And most of the articles have been on the UFOs and extraterrestrials. And so I've done a lot of research on the subject over that period of time. And when the time came to put the articles together for the book, the publisher selected 26 of those articles to be included as chapters of the book. So some of those articles do go, some of those chapters do go back quite a ways, but yet they're still very, very much contemporary.
Okay, so you've been writing for Atlantis Rising magazine, I think you said for about 14 years, but what is it before that, they got you interested in UFOs? I mean, did you see a UFO, or did you get abducted, or what got you interested in it?
I did. I had experience in the Air Force. I think was transformative. I was probably taken on board the craft. I woke up at 3 o'clock in the morning in my barracks room in the Air Force and ran to the window just in time to see a craft flashing by. And it was gold and green phosphorescent, and it was moving at a very high rate of speed. What caused me to wake up and run to the window, I have no idea. Now I'm beginning to put it together. Shortly thereafter, the next morning, the tower operators came in and said they had 4 UFOs on the radar that night over the runway. I said, well, I think I saw one. They said, well, why don't you go report it to the UFO office, which I did. And I found a captain sitting there with a multi-page questionnaire, which surprised me. And he was not at all surprised at my estimated speed of the craft and the fact that it was silent. So evidently he was used to getting these reports.
Mm-hmm.
And I found out later that he was probably working for Operation Blue Book.
What year was that?
The next day I got very sick. I was laid up in the hospital for 3 days. I found out later that this is not an uncommon reaction when somebody is taken on board a craft. So putting it all together, I have never been hypnotized to find out what happened, but I think that's what got me going on the whole subject.
What year did this encounter happen?
I'm sorry?
What year did the encounter happen?
That was in 1958.
Uh-huh. Okay, now, in your book, you've written, well, you write about a whole lot of topics that are just really interesting. But you wrote, well, I'll tell you what, before I get into that, let me give you an opportunity to do this. Because, like I say, folks, this book covers a lot of topics, lots of topics, okay? So you want to be sure and get your hands on it. And it'll provide you with some very interesting reading for quite some time, 312 pages. Now that you've written this book, The Secret History of Extraterrestrials, what are you aiming at with the book? What's your goal here?
Well, it's to bring consciousness of this reality into the public concourse and make people aware of the fact that this is the new reality that we're living in, and the fact that the government is taking all these extreme measures to cover it up is something we have to overcome and just become aware of it ourselves. It's an extremely important turning point in human history, and we have to become aware of it.
Well, the first thing that I want to talk about here, that's specifically in the book, actually I'm jumping a third of the way into the book to page 98. And this is where you talk about the Iraqi Stargate.
Okay.
Now, we'll go back and talk about some of the other things, but that's a hot item. That's a very hot item. When the United States decided to go into Iraq, almost immediately this story surfaced about that the real reason we were going in there was because there was an ancient Anunnaki Stargate. One of the versions of that story says that Saddam Hussein had located where it was and had a team of archaeologists from France and Germany working furiously in there to uncover the thing, and that is what triggered the invasion of Iraq. Because the American government did not want that technology to fall into the hands of Saddam Hussein. Now, that's one version of the story. There are some other versions. Quite obviously, if that's a true story, it would be very, very difficult to corroborate. If it's untrue, if it's untrue enough, it would be fairly easy to corroborate that it's untrue. For instance, if there was no team of archaeologists, and if that simply didn't happen, then that would discorroborate that story. But you've included that in your book, and I want you to talk to us about it and why you decided to include that in your book. Obviously, you have some confidence in it.
Well, it was part of the information that came out of my interview with Michael Sala. And your listeners may know that Sala was more or less the originator of the whole exopolitics concept.
Mm-hmm.
And this was Sala's theory, and he backed it up with some very, very impressive scholarship. A lot of his research was based on William Henry's writings. But what makes this thing very believable is the fact that we failed to defend the museum of Baghdad. The Marines just let that museum be looted, and part of the loot was 5,000 cylinder seals that were over 3,000 years old from Mesopotamia. And some of the scenes on those cylinder seals show the use of the Stargate. So that tends to support the theory that we wanted to get our hands on that information so we know how to use the Stargate once we uncovered it.
Okay, so then it would follow, if I understand what you're saying, it would follow that the Marines stood back, allowed that museum to be looted, and it was being looted by people in the employ of the U.S. government. Is that what you're saying?
That's the theory, yes. Uh-huh.
Who would that have been?
Otherwise, why would they allow an invaluable treasure of that museum to be openly looted if it wasn't being done by us?
Who would you say those people were? I mean, are they NSA? Are they CIA? Are they DIA? Who would have been the looters there?
Sala didn't identify them, but my guess, if I had to guess, would be the NSA, because, as we all know, the NSA was tasked with the whole problem of interacting with the extraterrestrials from the beginning. That was their assignment. So that would be my guess.
Do you know if anybody's been able to verify whether or not there was an archaeological team there digging?
I think that's common knowledge now. The Germans and the French were working at the city of Yurok with Saddam Hussein. I don't think that's a secret.
Well, yeah, but the problem with common knowledge is its origin.
Okay.
You know, it's like someone, I know you've done this, when you were a kid and you were at a party somewhere and you play this game they call gossip, or it goes by some other names, and somebody whispers something in someone's ear who whispers it in someone's ear who whispers it in someone's ear. It goes all the way around the room, and at the end, the person states what was just whispered in their ear, and it very often is not the same message that it was when it started out.
Well,
but along the way, everyone believes they got the right message.
Right.
And so sometimes what becomes common knowledge is someone whispers it on the internet, who then whispers it on the internet, and it begins to spread, and nobody knows the origin of it, and it just becomes common knowledge. But I'm wondering, is there any way that we could pinpoint that? Has anybody documented that it actually is true?
I didn't do a lot of extensive research on the subject, but I'm quite certain that if I were to Google German archaeological digs in Iraq, we would start to get the information, because I don't believe it was kept secret.
Okay. So they're digging, and do you know if this archaeological team actually found this artifact?
Well, you know, Yurok, the city of Yurok was the ancient capital. This is where the Book of Gilgamesh was located, was pinpointed. It's the center of the old Mesopotamian culture. I think you're probably aware of the fact that it's commonly believed that the Anunnaki, when they first came here, that's where they landed.
Mm-hmm.
I think Sitchin made reference to that. That it was Mount Hermon and Mesopotamia where the Anunnaki first came here.
Mm-hmm.
And so if we buy into the Sitchin writings, then there's another pointer to that fact. And of course, there's a lot of literature now about the Anunnaki and how they have been influencing worldwide events. That I, you know, no point getting into that now. That's all.
Yeah, but what about the archaeological team? Do you know if they actually found this Stargate?
Well, according to Sala, they did find the Stargate. Through the use of these cylinder seals, they were able to dope it out and to find it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, we've already had technology. We've already had Stargate.
Yeah,
Have you talked to Andrew Bustagio?
I have talked with him on the telephone. We've never had him on the show. We've tried to have him on the show, but he was too busy.
He's given some very convincing testimony that he himself went through the Stargate that he claims was built in a huge gymnasium in, I think he said in Maryland. I'm not sure.
Yeah, that would be our Stargate. Now, do you know this Stargate in Iraq? Is it now in the hands of the U.S. military?
That's my understanding. I can't back that up. That was the goal of the invasion, according to Sala and according to Henry, and that once we got our hands on it, and whether we've actually been able to use it or not, I don't know.
Yeah, that was my next question. Do you know if it's operational?
Well, see, if we already have the tech, we already knew about the Stargate technology, having developed it here. My guess is that there, and also through the Montauk program, that most likely they have figured out how to use it. Except that in order to go through the Stargate, it takes a certain level of consciousness, and I think that takes years to develop.
Mm-hmm.
An individual just can't walk through a Stargate without certain preparation. So it's not that simple. And Bustagio said the same thing.
Now, is that true of our Stargate that we built as well as this Iraqi Stargate?
Right. Bustagio had to go through considerable training before he was able to go through the Stargate. he was involved in Operation Pegasus, which was part of it. That's where he obtained that training. Well, that makes sense.
What would be the advantage to the U.S. government if we've already got a working Stargate? What would be the advantage to the U.S. government or the U.S. military of invading a country in order to seize a Stargate when we've already got one?
Okay, Sal's theory is that Planet X, or Nibiru, is about to make its 3,600-year return to the vicinity of this solar system.
Mm-hmm.
And when that happens, the Anunnaki, the old gods of Nibiru, will come through the Stargate to Iraq, and that will have the effect of propping up the regime of Saddam Hussein. And there goes our oil, and there goes our hegemony in the modern world. And that was Saleh's theory. And I just repeated that because the article was based on my interview with Saleh.
Do you think
he stands behind that idea?
Do you think Saleh's theory is solid? I mean, you actually interviewed him. You know what your impression was as you interviewed him. You think it's solid stuff?
You know, Saleh has a very impressive academic background, both in Australia and here. He's not some off-the-wall nut. He's a serious scholar.
Mm-hmm.
And I was very impressed with his scholarship and with how carefully he makes his arguments. To me, it all sounds very, very feasible and very likely. But the article itself was based on that interview.
What would be the fate of that Stargate? Is it? Do you have any idea where? Let's assume that his theory is correct. And let's assume that the Stargate actually existed and the U.S. military went in there and took control of it. Okay, what then was the fate of it? Is it in a warehouse somewhere, or is it still in Iraq? Do you have any idea?
I guess it would be it's in U.S. hands at this point. Mm-hmm. And according to Bisaggio, we routinely send people through teleportation all over the place, including to Mars. So if we have that ability, it's probably being used for that purpose. My understanding is there's another one in Giza. So, you know, all of these things are going on at very deep secret levels, but there's so much incredible stuff going on at secret levels in our government that none of this surprises me one bit.
Mm-hmm. The one at Giza, whose control is it under?
Well, presumably, you know, the German archaeologists were also very, very active over there.
Mm-hmm.
They were working on that robot that was supposed to go down the shaft of the Great Pyramid.
Yeah.
So, you know, there again, there's the German archaeology teams working there, too. Whether or not it's in the control of the Egyptian government or whether we have something to do with it, or I have no idea.
Fair enough. Tell you what, we're going to step away for a break here in just a few seconds. And we will continue, ladies and gentlemen, on the other side of the break, talking with Lynn Kasten about some of the stuff in this book called The Secret History of Extraterrestrials. We shall return right after this. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening is Lynn Kasten. Lynn, we were talking about this Stargate in Iraq. Now, what I'm about to ask you is not specifically addressed in your book, but I know it's bound to be something that you've considered, and I know I'm asking you for speculation, but I'd just like to get your thoughts on this. We know that the president, who at that time was George W. Bush, was told that it is a, quote, slam dunk that the Iraqis have weapons of mass destruction. And not only do we know he was told that, we know who told him that. It was the director of the CIA at the time, Mr. Tenet. And we also know that the same message was told to General Colin Powell. Is it possible, and we now know that was not accurate information. All right. Now, is it possible that there was some group of people, are you still with us? Hello? Well, okay, his phone just blinked out. That's interesting. Let's see if he calls back in, and if he does not, we will attempt to get in touch with him. But where I'm headed with this, folks, is it possible that there's a group of people? Interesting. A shadow group, if you will, who knew about the Stargate, used weapons of mass destruction as the cover, told that to the president and to Colin Powell. And is it possible that all of this was done without the president's knowledge? Now, I know there are people who hate George Bush. I know that is the case. On the other hand, it is possible, isn't it, that George Bush was kept in the dark all the way through this. All right, let's see if we can get our guest back with us here. Well, ladies and gentlemen, looks like we may have to go to open line. Lynn has a landline, and when I call that number, there's a horrible squeal in it. And so I reestablished contact with him on his cell phone, and it went off air almost immediately. What do you make of that, huh? I don't know. Well, we shall proceed forward here, and we will go to open line, and we will try to get Lynn back with us on the air for an interview some point here in the future. The telephone number is 623-444-5889. And, I really wish we could do this interview tonight. It looks like that's not going to be possible. Because there is in this book, ladies and gentlemen, really a ton of information. Now, I don't know if someone is interfering with his telephone. You heard it. You heard what happened. There was a beep and then it went completely silent. Well, let's see if this is Lynn. Is this Lynn?
Yes, it is.
Okay, Lynn, I don't know. If we get cut off again, I'm going to have to go to open line. I don't know. We heard a beep, and then your phone went dead. And so,
okay, let's give it another try. If it doesn't work, then we'll have to reschedule. I'll have to get some more a different telephone.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I don't know if it's your telephone or if you're getting some assistance.
Oh, I see. That
yeah.
Could be.
Okay, so I'm going to ask the question, Lynn, that I started to ask. We know that Director of the CIA, George Tenet, gave the president the information that there were weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. And when questioned about it by the president, he said, it's a slam dunk. That's on the record. He gave the same information to General Colin Powell. And then, as we know, there weren't any weapons of mass destruction found in Iraq. At least no nuclear weapons. There was a great deal of very high explosive found. And it's the type of high explosive that is used for the detonators on atomic weapons. It's a very powerful explosive. That was found, tons of it. But other than that, there were no weapons of mass destruction found. Now, my question is, and it's speculation I'm asking you for here, but you've obviously researched this in doing your writing, and you've had some thoughts about it, I'm sure. And so we understand it's speculation. But is it possible that, we have to ask, why would the director of the CIA tell the president and the secretary of state that it's a slam dunk, they've got weapons of mass destruction? Why would he do that if it weren't true?
You know, even Colin Powell got into that.
Yeah, Colin Powell questioned him on it, and the director of the CIA told him, it's a slam dunk, they've got it.
Well, my speculation would be they couldn't say that they were going to invade Iraq because of the Stargate, could they?
Well, here's one thing that I'm wondering. What if the president and the secretary of state were kept completely out of the loop on the Stargate by whatever dark group there is operating as a shadow government?
Mm-hmm.
The shadow government decides that the president and the secretary of state are going to be told this story about it's a slam dunk on the weapons of mass destruction. That's their cover. That's how they get the president and the secretary of state to get behind the idea of invading Iraq, but never tell them about the Stargate. Maybe they never knew. Maybe the whole thing was a scam on the presidency and on the government. What do you think?
That wouldn't surprise me at all. It sounds very likely that the NSA doesn't share its secrets with everybody. And as we all know, many presidents have been kept out of the loop in terms of top secret information. So that wouldn't be surprising me at all.
Now, doesn't it seem logical that if the director of the CIA tells the president of the USA, Mr. President, it's a slam dunk, they have weapons of mass destruction, And then he tells that same thing to the Secretary of State, who then goes in front of the United Nations and makes that case. And then it all turns out to not be true. Doesn't it seem logical that they would call this guy on the carpet?
Well, of course they would call him on the carpet. And Tenet lost a lot of credibility as a result of this whole. And so did Colin Powell.
Yes, with the press, and because of the press, with the people. And yet the government stood behind Tenet, and he was never prosecuted.
Well, you know what happens at those levels. Those people very seldom get prosecuted for these things. They always find an excuse. But it certainly does tie in very nicely with the fact that it was a cover story for the Stargate incident.
Now,
it doesn't make sense.
The implications of
how could the intelligence people have gotten it so wrong?
Well, actually, I don't think they got it wrong. I think it was. I think that by the time it all got up to the top guy in intelligence, that's where it got perverted, and that's he told the president it's a slam dunk. The lower levels, as the congressional investigations showed, the lower levels, being the analysts themselves, they never confirmed that there were weapons of mass destruction there. So somewhere up above them is where it got perverted, diverted, and given to the president and the Secretary of State in the form of, Mr. President, it's a slam dunk. They've got weapons of mass destruction. But the implications of this, Lynn, would be that whoever these dark lords are have elements in the military loyal to them, willing to run this side operation during the invasion of Iraq, using the invasion of Iraq as a cover.
Well, you know, a lot of people who are insiders refer to this group as the Cabal.
Mm-hmm.
It's a group within the military and within the military-industrial complex that answers to no one but themselves. And this is more or less common knowledge these days. Certainly people like Dr. Richard Boylan have written extensively on this. Dr. Michael Wolff, who wrote the book The Catches of Heaven, you know, everyone seems to know now about this cabal, and what they do above the law and in top secrecy. So it's not surprising that they could have pulled this off easily.
Well, I want to make it clear to our audience that neither you or me, neither you nor I, are saying that for sure this Stargate story is true. You're saying it has some credibility, and that, you know, it seems to you that credibility is fairly weighty. So we're not saying that this story of the Stargate in Iraq is absolutely a fact. But if it is, given the assumption that it is, then it certainly points to some very dark operations taking place, and causes one to wonder how the director of the CIA could tell the president and the secretary of state something so erroneous and get away with it. We have to take a break. We'll be back. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening is Lynn Kasten. Lynn, are you still with us?
Yes, I am, Kevin.
Outstanding.
On the subject of the Stargate, I'd like to read. Have you interviewed Robert O. Dean yet?
Oh, yeah, several times.
I'd like to read you a quote that Bob Dean gave to me.
Mm-hmm.
He said a couple of things that I have found to be factual and true, and one of them is that deep underground facility outside of Las Vegas, where this Air Force colonel friend of mine went through one door in Nevada, and in 2 minutes he was in Pine Gap, Australia. So you see, there are many other reports of these types of technologies that we have developed.
I don't have any doubt whatsoever about us having that technology. The only thing that, and it's not that I doubt the Stargate, Iraqi Stargate story, but the only thing that I would like to be able to do is nail down, you know, for instance, you have Bob Dean who is telling you about a personal friend of his who has been through that Stargate in Las Vegas. So far on the Iraqi Stargate, we don't have any names attached. We don't have anybody coming forward yet and saying, yeah, it's true. I was there. I saw it. And so, you know, that's, while it's intriguing, that's still one that, you know, we have to kind of say, well, maybe it would not be outside the realm of possibility, but we just don't have anything nailed down on that yet. At least not to my knowledge. Of course, I don't know everything. So maybe we do, and I'm just not aware of it. But
well,
what's really interesting to me about...
Bashar said he went through a Stargate in 1972 in Cerritos, New Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there are many other reports of us having this technology.
Yeah, but the Iraqi Stargate, we don't have nailed down. However...
Exactly, we don't.
However, I find it glaring that the director of the CIA got a pat on the back after, and he was the former director by that point, after, based on his report to the president and the secretary of state, we invaded Iraq, and then it turned out there were no weapons of mass destruction, and after that, he's still getting a, he got a pat on the back from the president. He got a pat on the back from other people that spoke about his years of service and so forth. It's as though they were covering something for him.
Yeah. Well, that would imply to me that perhaps the Stargate concept was known at some very high levels after all.
Well, it certainly points that direction. It doesn't nail it down, but it certainly, as I say on this show, it causes one to raise an eyebrow and say,
Exactly.
All right. So let's go back to let's go forward actually. Let's go forward to what you had to say about the B-2. You call it the American UFO.
Right.
Why do you call the B-2, which of course is the stealth bomber, why do you call it the American UFO?
Well, I have two chapters in the book on that. One was based on the research of somebody called somebody named Tony Gonzalez, who did the research on it and came to the conclusion that the B-2 bomber, this was way back in the 80s, that the B-2 bomber had anti-gravity technology on board that was able to take off conventionally and then fly around the world without refueling. Then this was subsequently confirmed by the research of Robert LaViolette, who wrote the book Anti-Gravity Propulsion, and he made the same claim. As a physicist, he had other sources of information. So it's coming from many different sources now that the B-2 has anti-gravitics on board, and the fact that it's based in the middle of the country in Missouri and able to fly around the world from Missouri would tend to indicate that it has that capability.
I talked with a soldier who he worked at the same sheriff's office that I worked at. And when Gulf War I broke out, he was in the reserve. They called him up, and he had to go do a tour in Gulf War I. When he finished that tour, he came back and resumed his duties as a sheriff's deputy. And he was a heck of a guy, really good guy. And he said, you wouldn't believe some of the stuff they field tested, they battle tested. And one of the things he told me about, he didn't go into any detail, he said it's a zero flight time weapon. And I said, what do you mean by zero flight time? He said, well, in conventional weapons, you pull a trigger or you push a button and it ignites a missile or it fires a bullet, and a projectile comes out one way or the other. It's a missile or it's a bullet. And it flies through the air. So there's a period of time for it to get from the weapon where it's fired to the target. He said, they have a weapon that's zero flight time. When they activate it instantaneously, the target is destroyed. I said, you know, this is Gulf War I, right? I mean, we're talking 1990?
Right.
And I said, you're kidding. He said, not kidding at all. But he also said there are aircraft that he did not see, but others did and told him about it. Other soldiers saw it and told him about it, that just float up on the enemy with no noise whatsoever. That would be the type of technology that you're talking about here.
Yes, exactly. The anti the V-2 is absolutely silent. It makes no noise whatsoever when it's in anti-gravity mode. But beyond that, according to Richard Boylan, we have aircraft that go through a quantum field and can disappear at one point and reappear at another. And that sounds to me like it's very much what you're talking about.
Well, that would not surprise me either. Now, I've made mention of this on air, so my audience will be familiar with this. But I want them to be familiar with this. I want them to remember, during Gulf War I, on the ground, the troops were being commanded by Storman Norman, Norman Schwarzkopf. And General Schwarzkopf gave an interview, not an interview, a press conference during Gulf War I, in which he was talking about what would happen. In fact, a reporter asked the question, so what's next if Saddam Hussein doesn't surrender? And he said, we have things to throw at him he cannot even imagine.
Mm-hmm.
And the reporter said, what do you mean? Can you elaborate? He said, well, all this technology that you've been seeing that everybody is oohing and aahing over is obsolete. And he said, we've got technology way beyond that. And if this doesn't get it, we have things to throw at him he can't even imagine. Well, I remember during Gulf War I, and you do too, don't you? You remember Gulf War I. The whole world was just awestruck by these smart bombs and smart missiles flying right down a smokestack or going through a particular window. And, you know, we were just awestruck by this. And then you have General Schwarzkopf saying to the press, and it was on television, that's all obsolete.
Well, if you remember the initial bombing of Baghdad, the bombers appeared over Baghdad having flown silently and unobtrusively through, I think, perhaps 1,000 miles of Iraqi airspace without being detected, and all of a sudden they were over Baghdad, and they were completely silent overhead. The reporters for CNN remarked of the fact that there was no sound coming from overhead as these bombs dropped all over Baghdad.
Yeah.
It was as if whoever dropping the bombs was silently hovering overhead.
Okay, we have to take a break. We'll pick up there with the B-2 when we come back. Don't go away, folks. More after this. Listening to the Kevin Smith Show. For those of you who are joining us just now in this second hour, welcome aboard. I'm delighted you are here. And my sympathy for whatever kept you from the first hour, but we're glad you're here now. And we're talking this evening with Lynn Kasten. He is the author of a book called The Secret History of Extraterrestrials. Lynn, did you make it through the break? Are you still with us?
I am still here.
Okay. What other aircraft are you aware of besides the B-2 that may have this anti-gravity or electrogravitic devices on it?
Well, Dr. Blowen talks about the Aurora. He talks about the TAW. He talks about an aircraft that actually goes through quantum field mm-hmm. and disappears at one point and reappears at another. Disappears at one altitude and reappears at another. There's so much going on in that black world that is absolutely incredible that it's too much to even get into at this point.
You've written about the policies of anti-gravity. What policies are we talking about here?
Say that again, I'm sorry.
You've written about the policies of anti-gravity. What policies are we talking about?
Politics, yeah. Let's see. Dr. Boylan talks about the following aircraft. Let's see if I can give you that information. He talks about aircraft that not only anti-gravity, but that he has one called the TAW. And, you know, he talks about a military space station that is being kept secret for 30 years, that we routinely go back and forth to that space station, to Mars and to the moon, using anti-gravity aircraft. And Robert Dean said the same thing. So, you know, it's coming from a lot of different directions.
In part three of your book, you talk about the policies of anti-gravity. What are we talking about here? What are the policies that we're talking about?
Well, politics. It's the politics of anti-gravity.
Okay, yeah, the politics. What are we talking about here with the politics of anti-gravity?
Well, I think you may be aware, since you know a little bit about the military and what's been developed, that we were doing anti-gravity research in the 1950s.
Mm-hmm.
46 different aerospace companies were involved in it. Numerous colleges and universities were involved in it. We had developed, by the end of the 50s, we already had working anti-gravity craft.
Okay.
The politics of anti-gravity refers to the fact that to make it public would mean the end of our dependence on oil. And that is a very highly charged political problem, economic problem. They're not going to allow that to happen at this point because the entire world economy is oil-based. So if they were to turn over the anti-gravity technology to the commercial aviation, we would be using very little oil,
mm-hmm.
if any. So it is political, basically.
So our current sad state of affairs on this planet are tied to not a lack of technology, but a lack of honesty about it.
Well, that's my belief. The entire world oil banking economy, international economy, is based on oil.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, most of the money that's being kept in these large banks is oil money. So the banks and the oil companies together are in it together. Certainly neither of them would like to see oil go away.
Well, and there are a lot of things tied to the oil economy where people don't suspect that's the case. For instance, you may have some small investors, you know, just a guy and his wife, and they've put away a little money each month and bought a few stocks here and a few stocks there. And over the years, they've accumulated enough to make life at least livable, if not comfortable, maybe comfortable in the retirement years. But they've never invested in oil, and yet, unbeknownst to them, companies they have invested in may be invested in oil. And so if the oil economy collapses, it could cause the collapse of all these other companies that are invested in oil. And so the small stockholder gets hurt, even though they don't know they are tied to oil in any way.
Exactly.
So it has a
Absolutely.
Ripple effect.
Yep.
All right, now I want to move to a really big, big topic, at least from my perspective, and that's your chapter on life in the Milky Way. Life in the Milky Way. Well, we've got NASA saying they're looking for life. You've got me saying NASA's already found it. And there are other people. I'm not the only one. But me and people like me saying, hey, look, NASA has already found it. And they've already leaked the information, maybe inadvertently, but they've leaked it. And now it's time to just fess up, you know, and just tell the truth. They have found extraterrestrial life out there. At least that's my opinion, based on what I see coming out of NASA. What do you say about life in the Milky Way in this book?
Well, that particular chapter, Life in the Milky Way, was about the pulsars and Paul LaViolette's theory that the pulsars are really messages coming from other civilizations, and they are not just spinning hulks of old stars, that really we are in communication with many other star systems through these pulsar signals. That's LaViolette's theory. I also wrote a chapter on Project Serpo, which covers the fact that we sent 12 astronauts to a planet that's 37 light years away in 1965.
Mm-hmm.
So there's both of those chapters discussing life in the Milky Way.
Well, you know, and that's another story, that the Project Serpo story that has come under a lot of fire. I mean, just because it's come under fire doesn't mean it isn't true. But it has come under a lot of fire. The interesting thing about that story, 1998, and I know for sure it was in 1998, I read about that on the fledgling internet. And the reason I know it was 1998 is because I had just returned from my first overseas mission, which was in Bosnia. And I had just finished and just returned. And so I got onto this fledgling internet, and out there I found this story. It was not called Project Serpo, to the best of my memory. I'm not sure that it named it. But the story was there. So it's been around for a long time. And then it came back again in full bloom as Project Serpo. And I've talked to a couple of people who claim to be in the know and claim that, well, they have the credentials to where you would certainly expect they could be in the know. And they say that it was real, and that the basic story that's in Serpo is accurate, but it wasn't called Project Serpo. And when I asked what was it called, neither one of these people would tell me. But that story's been out there for a while.
I wasn't aware that it was out. It's been out there since 1998. The emails that first described it came from somebody named Anonymous in 2005.
Mm-hmm.
But it wouldn't surprise me that it would have been out there in 1998. And by the way, it was originally called Project Crystal Knight.
Mm-hmm.
Knight spelled K-N-I-G-H-T. It became known as Project Serpo, but its formal name was Operation Crystal Knight.
And I wish I could say that I remember that that's what it was called, but in what I read, I simply don't recall what it said the name was back in 1998. But this is, of course, a story that was sort of the basis of that ending scene in Close Encounters of the Third Kind,
right,
where some of the aliens get off of their spaceship and stay here, and 12 astronauts get on board and fly away.
Right.
So what level of confidence do you place in this story about Serpo?
Well, I talk about the website, www.serpo.org. There's actually a ton of information, and it's very detailed on that website. The fact that that the commander of the mission kept a diary, and the entries from his diary are on that website. He actually gives his impressions upon his first seeing the planet, stepping off the spaceship, the fact that they saw two suns in the sky, the fact that that one of the people died and the aliens took the body and tried to clone a human being. It's all out there. So it's out there for anyone to read. I just put it all together and put it into one chapter.
Well, what's your personal opinion of it? Do you think that's real?
Absolutely, and I think Spielberg had an inside track on it and wanted to get it out there. Even though his consultant on the movie was Alan Hynek, he didn't get the information from Hynek. He got it from somebody else who you might call a deep throat from the Defense Intelligence Agency, and that's how he was able to do the movie.
You write in your book about sci-fi film and the role it plays. How much of what we're seeing in sci-fi is based on reality?
A lot of people now believe that there are two groups within the secret military-industrial complex and within the intelligence community. One group, who they call the good guys, would like to see this information revealed. Another group does not want it revealed. I think those that want it revealed are putting the information out to Hollywood, and the Hollywood producers and directors are picking it up and turning it into fiction, but it's based on fact. And I think that's the reason. It's a slow acclimation process. It's a process of acclimating the public consciousness to what's going on through what appears to be fiction. And I think Spielberg is in on that, and I think several other people in Hollywood are. Perhaps Cameron, too.
You know, do you remember this movie called Mission to Mars?
Yes, I do, vaguely, huh?
Okay, and, you know, they land on Mars, and there's a colony, if you will, of astronauts that's been pretty much wiped out, but there's one guy still living, and they find him, and they, through a series of events, they finally wind up inside the face on Mars. And when they get on the inside, it's fairly, we would say, miraculous in there. The technology's just phenomenal. One of the big financial backers of that movie, so I have been told by numerous sources, was NASA. And I've wondered, are they trying to tell us, through this fiction, the real story?
Well, yes, I think so. I think there is definitely a public acclimation program to slowly reveal the truth, because if they were to keep it all bottled up and let us have it all at once, it would be so shocking to our complete culture that literally it would be way beyond the whole War of the Worlds scenario. So they've had to let it come out in small ways, and I believe that NASA's probably involved in that, yes. And Andrew Bisciaggio, who talked about being teleported to Mars, did say that he was teleported to what appeared to be a large face on Mars. Whether or not it was the face on Mars, I don't know. But he did claim that. So that's a tie-in right there.
You know, Wouldn't it just be cool if you could get in on one of those transports and wind up on Mars? Would you do it?
Would I do it?
Yeah.
I don't think so. I'm not ready to go to Mars.
Man, if NASA called me tomorrow and they said, you know what, we've got a spaceship, it's headed to Mars, or the moon, either one. We've got one seat left on there. We had an astronaut that got sick. We've got one seat. And you can go if you want to. Rocket's got a little problem with it. There's about a 50-50 chance of you making it. But there's a seat on there if you want it. I'd take it.
You would, huh?
Yeah, I would. I want to know.
Yeah, Robert Dean said there's a city the size of Chicago under the surface of Mars. Are you familiar with that?
Yeah. Yeah.
And that city is not just Martians, but there are many, many humans in that city. And you may know the story of Laura Magdalene Eisenhower, who claimed that she was invited to go there.
Yeah.
So I think we've had a presence on Mars for quite a long time now. And I think we've got several joint projects going on there with the Martians. One of the chapters in my book is about that glass city they built in the Arizona desert, which was really a practice city for moving it to Mars. So,
okay, tell us about that. Tell us about the glass city.
It's unbelievable.
Yeah, tell us about the glass city.
Well, you know, it's called the Biosphere 2.
Mm-hmm.
And the money from it came from one individual who was a relative who had all the Texas oil money at his disposal, who put $200 million into the development of that project, which was at that time about 25% of his entire fortune. His name was Bass. He was one of the four Bass brothers from Texas.
Mm-hmm.
And why he would have done that without any hope of any profit, right there you have to ask, well, why would he do that? In any case, they said from the beginning that it was going to be a prototype colony for Mars. And they made no secret of it at the outset. And it was easily transportable because it was constructed like a geodesic dome where they could take panels and put them all together when they got to the Martian surface. So I believe they've been working on these self-sustaining communities that they can move to other planets for quite a long time, and the Biosphere was the perfect example of that. There probably are many others besides that one. And the Russians had a lot to do with the development of that project.
You know, Mars is something that I'm very, very interested in. It's something that I don't think that NASA has told us the truth about the true conditions on Mars. And in fact, I've done shows. Last Friday night's show, I did part of the show where I talked about NASA hasn't told us the truth about the real conditions on Mars, and I used some of their own photographs to prove it. And but a lot of people think that Mars is like, you know, 300 degrees below zero and there's no possible way you could live there. And most people have no idea that around the equator of Mars in the summertime, it gets up to 80 degrees Fahrenheit in the day.
Wow, I didn't know that.
It gets up to 80 degrees Fahrenheit. Now, it gets real cold at night. But up to 80 degrees Fahrenheit. So if you had a temporary shelter you could get in the nighttime, you could do a whole lot of building in the daytime.
Right.
And I'm just curious as to is that perhaps where some of this colonization has taken place. All right, now.
Well, the Biosphere 2 was built by an organization called Space Biosphere Ventures. And that tells the story right there. And several articles were written by Paul Allen, who was the developer of Space Biosphere Ventures, saying that Biosphere was a prototype colony for Mars.
Now, so, Paul Allen, wasn't Paul
really
Allen...
very well kept secret at all.
Wasn't Paul Allen affiliated with Microsoft at one point?
No, it's not that Allen. It's a different Allen.
Okay.
This particular Allen has a long ecological development history.
All right. Now, you've when we talk about life in the Milky Way and we talk about this glass city and we're talking about colonies on Mars and colonies on the moon, there's a curious chapter you have, it's curious to me, called The Monuments of the Gods. Talk to us about that, and then I'll tell you why that's curious to me.
Well, that chapter was based on an interview with Robert Pavel. You may know that Pavel was the one who discovered that the three stars in the belt of Orion are in the same exact order as the three pyramids of Giza.
Yeah.
And but up to the point of that interview, Pavel had never taken the position that extraterrestrials were involved in Giza. However, as we spoke, the more we proceeded in the interview, ultimately he acknowledged that most likely, according to the Egyptian Book of the Dead and other writings, Giza was probably built by extraterrestrials, or at least influenced or helped by extraterrestrials from Orion. And so that's what that chapter is based on. And, you know, of course, Sitchin and von Däniken and others have all made that claim, so it's nothing new.
Okay. When we're talking about the monuments of the gods, we're talking about, for instance, the pyramids at Giza, including the Great Pyramid. I would presume we're talking about the massive, massive stone slabs that were cut at Baalbek. I would presume we're talking also about the massive stone structures in Central and South America, and possibly the pyramids in China as well.
Right. And also Easter Island.
Easter Island. Now, the question that I have is, if these beings that came here, that our ancestors referred to as gods, if these beings had this super technology, hyper technology, if you will, the question then would be, why were they building with huge rocks? If they had that super technology, why wouldn't they build with, for instance, glass, as we're told they did on the moon?
Evidently, they wanted something that they knew would have to last for a long time, because I think the Great Pyramid of Giza, they knew, would eventually be underwater. And that's why it was sealed. They were projecting these projects way into the future. And stones and huge boulders was one way to assure the fact that these things would last for a long time. I don't think something made out of glass would ever last that long.
All right, so they're building these things and projecting into the future. Any idea why they built them?
Well, I don't know. I have no idea. Why did they put the lines of Nazca in Peru? I have no idea. They had a motive to do it, and perhaps they wanted us to discover these monuments, or whatever you want to call them, mm-hmm. far into the future, and so we would know that they were here. I don't know.
Well, that sort of indicates they're coming back.
Exactly, and that's what we were talking about before about the Iraqi Stargate, that perhaps there was that fear that they would, that when Nibiru came close to Earth again, they would come through the Stargate and set up their encampment in Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
So perhaps that's the case. But, you know, others claim that they never really left, that there are many, many extraterrestrials living deep underground. It happened for a long time.
All right, we have to step away for a break, and we shall return right after this, so don't go away. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening, Lynn Kasten, the author of The Secret History of Extraterrestrials. Now, Lynn, when we went away for break, you were just making the point that there are people who say, and these are some of them credible people, some of them, of course, there's always a few squirrels around any issue, but there are some credible people who are saying that the Anunnaki never really left, and that they have bases underground, perhaps under the ocean, and that they are still here, an outpost of them, still here. And that may be the case. You've written in your book a chapter called Battleground Earth. Actually, pretty interesting stuff. Why do you see the Earth as a battleground?
Well, to me, as far as I'm concerned, the entire fascist movement was coordinated beyond just those countries involved. There was something else involved there, and it was basically an overt attempt to take over the planet and to enslave the planet. That was the intent of World War II, as far as I was concerned. And the more I researched it and the more I looked into it, I began to see that Hitler's development of flying saucers, which he did have, and some of the weaponry that he developed, so-called wonder weapons, were not something that would have been developed by his scientists. They came from somewhere else. And that was definitely an attempt of these three nations, Italy, Germany, and Japan, to basically take over the planet and to enslave it. And the fact that the Japanese had become the primary naval power in the world, whereas the Germans were more or less they were more or less developing weapons for land-based takeovers. It seemed to be just too much that they would not have gotten together and done this planning, this long-range planning, well in advance, and there was an alien involvement in the whole thing.
Do you think that Battleground Earth is all in the past, or you think it's still a battleground, or do you think that it shall be yet a battleground?
I think we had some extraterrestrials helping us, and that's why we won. I think after they lost, they decided to try a different tack, and they decided that...
So you mean after the Axis powers lost?
I'm sorry?
When you said after they lost, you're talking about the Axis powers?
Yes.
Okay.
I think they decided to try and do it through mind control. A lot of ex-Nazi scientists did come over here under Operation Paperclip. I think you're aware of that, right?
Oh, yeah. We've done shows on it.
And a lot of them were not only weaponry-oriented, they were biotechnically oriented. And then I think a lot of them did sort of infiltrate our intelligence agencies, including the CIA. And we already know that the CIA was involved in mind control experimentation in the 50s.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that what they failed to do through brute force, they've now decided to do through mind control. And they can accomplish the same effect, the same end, that way. Instead of taking us over physically, they'll take us over mentally or psychologically.
How successful do you think they are being at taking us over mentally and psychologically?
I think they've made great strides. I think that we are all being manipulated. I think we're all being manipulated. And it's very hard to fight our way out of this manipulation. I think the media have all been taken over. I think Hollywood to a large extent. I think you know by now that getting at the truth is a very difficult job. I think they were using us for their own purposes.
What do you think those purposes are?
Well, I think this sort of is a form of enslavement. We work hard. We give our energies for their purposes, and we get paid a pittance for a wage.
Mm-hmm.
So, whereas the real wealth is being vacuumed up to some other elite group. And I think that the enslavement that they failed to accomplish during World War II, they've managed to accomplish without a physical takeover. That's the way I look at it.
So how far do you think we are from overt disclosure? And secondly, is there a coming war, the results of which will be breaking the back of this cabal?
Well, I think there are other forces at work here. There are other extraterrestrials who do watch over the whole situation. Are you there?
We're listening.
Okay. And I think that ultimately they will be more or less vanquished, and we will develop into a more of a sort of utopian civilization on this planet. I don't know how long it's going to take, but I think that that's going to happen.
Do you think that overt, open disclosure by the U.S. government is ever going to happen on this subject of UFOs and extraterrestrials?
I don't think so. I think the only way it's going to happen is through a mass landing. And the only way that the ETs will actually affect a mass landing is if the consciousness of the planet is ready for it. I don't think we're ready for it yet. I think they're trying to get us ready for it. And so they're going to take disclosure out of the hands of the government and just do it themselves.
You know, I've heard this theory of ETs before. And it's my personal view that the ETs are not coming here to help us. Okay? That's my personal view. I don't think they're going to rescue us. Okay. Now, having said that, I have heard this theory that they're not going to make open contact with a mass landing or anything like that until our consciousness is ready. And that sounds a whole lot like bankers. Bankers will never lend you money when you need it. They only lend money to people who don't need it. If you need it, then they assume you can't pay it back. If you don't need it, they assume you can pay it back, and they beg you to take their money.
Well, I think, Kevin, there is a non-interventionist ethos involved here.
Mm-hmm.
They're not really supposed to intervene by whoever is watching, whoever is making the rules here. I don't know who they are.
Mm-hmm.
So they can only hope to expand our consciousness through other means, and hope that we will eventually reach the point when our consciousness is sufficiently expanded that we will then welcome them as brothers, and then it'll happen. But we're not ready for it at this point. And Bob Dean said the same thing. Bob Dean said that we're just not ready, and it's going to take a little time.
I want to jump back to the very beginning of your book, the very first chapter. You talk about George Adamski, and the title of that chapter is George Adamski, Emissary from Earth. George Adamski is, and let me say this for everyone in the audience. Folks, you have to understand, anyone who's on the cutting edge of anything, regardless of what it is controversial. George Adamski was very controversial. And there are people today who will claim that nothing George Adamski ever said has been disproved. His photographs have been verified as real. There are others who say he was completely discredited and, you know, he was a fraud. Okay, so, but you take the position that Adamski was credible. Why? What made you take that position?
You know, there were a lot of people that were trying to debunk the the contactees all through the 50s, including Van Tassel. There were people who did not want us to believe that it was possible that we were being contacted by extraterrestrials. So I think the debunkers were very effective in making us doubt that Adamski was genuine. But I have no doubt in my mind that he was. The stories and the books that he's written are very convincing as far as I'm concerned. And a lot of it has been validated. A lot of what he said has already been validated, including the photos that he took. The photos that he took of the bell-shaped craft, which are available on the Internet, turned out to be exactly the same as other craft that were later photographed. So I think there's so much evidence that he was the real thing. And he really wasn't in it for the money, that's for sure, because he didn't make very much on it, or the notoriety.
There is another case of someone who has had very long contact and received very detailed information from extraterrestrials, Billy Meyer.
Right.
And a great deal of the Billy Meyer information has been validated. Did you take a look at the Meyer case?
I know. I've done a lot of research on the Meyer case. It was just too big and complicated to include in the book. And
what do you think about it?
I think it was valid. For a one-armed man to have taken all those photographs and videos just doesn't make sense. I think that they did decide to contact him for some reason, perhaps because of past life connections, and that he was given a lot of information and given those incredible photographs. The photographs have never been debunked,
mm-hmm.
and they're crystal clear. So my own feeling is that Meyer is the real thing.
Some of the most astounding things about the Meyer case, in my opinion, are not the photographs. Photographs are interesting. But where he has written down what they told him, and you know exactly what date it was that they told him this, and each line is numbered so it can't be switched around later and you know, edited around. It is what it is. And some of the events that they told him were going to happen 20 years before they happened, you know, and then bang, it happened. And it happened exactly as is contained in the Meyer information. To me, that's really phenomenal and a little bit, I would say, beyond the ability of anybody to debunk.
Furthermore, they gave him a lot of, Semyasi, who was his contact, gave him a lot of technical information that has later turned out to be very valid. So you got that too.
So what do you think? Who are these people? He calls them Pleiarians. Other people call them Pleiadians. Who are these people?
I think that we're descended from them. They are more or less our brothers and sisters. I don't think we originated here ourselves. I think we came. You know, there were human beings all over the galaxy. They're not just here. They're not even just in the Pleiades. What we call the human race supposedly originated on the star system Lyra, and had to leave that star system because of a war, and then migrated to the Pleiades. And I think the Pleiadians had a lot to do with us. So really, we're related to them.
Are the Anunnaki the same as the Pleiadians?
No.
Okay. We have to take a break. We'll pick up there when we come back, and I'll explain why I asked that question. We'll be back right after this. All welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening, Lynn Kasten. Lynn, I had asked a question just as the break was taking over. You were answering it. I asked if the Anunnaki were the same as the Pleiadians or Pleiarans, and you said no, they're not. Here's the reason I asked. In the Sumerian story, we have, according to Sitchin, the Sumerians telling us that the Anunnaki did genetic engineering and created what is today us. Now, if that's the case, how could we be related to the Pleiadians?
You know, according to Sitchin, the Anunnaki came here 400,000 years ago and created they took the primate race, added their genetics, and created a slave race to mine the gold.
Mm-hmm.
You know that story, right?
Yes.
Now, 400,000 years ago, I think, was prior to Cro-Magnon man. We were dealing then with, I think, Neanderthal. So I think whatever race they created has died out a long time ago.
Okay. So then who did us?
I think we're from somewhere else. We're not from here.
Okay, so we came here.
I don't think I'm from here. I'll tell you the truth. So,
so we would have come here sort of as colonists or something and got left behind. Is that it?
Well, you know about the story of Lemuria, right? And of Atlantis?
Yes.
I think that the human race as we know it was originally colonized. That Lemuria was originally colonized by ETs from perhaps Lyra or the Pleiades.
Okay, and then they just kind of got left behind.
Well, there is still an underground city, supposedly under Mount Shasta, of those original colonists. Supposedly still here. So, I think that's the way I put it all together. The Anunnaki came back perhaps several times since that initial creation. And supposedly have been involved in trying to enslave us.
So the Anunnaki are bad guys.
That's my view. I don't know if you want to call them bad guys. They're just powerful entities. Their interests are not in helping us spiritually. That's not their concern.
You talk about the web of the Spider Woman. What is that about? Who is the Spider Woman?
Well, according to the Hopi mythology, the Spider Woman created the human race. So, I was just using that metaphor to introduce the whole story of the Hopi and their prophecies about the end times. And you know, the Hopi claim that they're from the Pleiades, and that they will go back there after the so-called war. Day of purification. So I just wanted to make that connection between the fact that the Hopi themselves and their prophecies are based on the fact that they themselves feel that they are extraterrestrials.
You know, a number of indigenous peoples talk about being from somewhere else and that they are extraterrestrial. The Dogon, for instance.
Exactly.
They are from, they say, a planet around in the Sirius star system.
Right.
And I guess it would be possible that we could have on this planet the descendants of colonists from all over the galaxy.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, Bob Dean says there are only four civilizations visiting us, but I think it's more like 50 or 60. I think it's a very large number. We hear stories about people that are shaped entities that look like insects and all kinds of entities have been. The Bigfoot. I mean, there's so much going on here that it's hard to put it all in one basket.
Well, it could also account for the various, we say, the various ethnic groups on this planet. Yes. Now, I'm about to say something that I don't want anybody to get all upset about this. It's not, it has nothing to do with political correctness or incorrectness. My wife happens to be Asian. Asians tend to have distinctively different features than Europeans. And there's right. nothing that I'm saying here that's racial or anything. I mean, come on, folks, for God's sake, I'm married to her. But it's a fact that there are facial features and other features. For instance, in Thailand, she's from Thailand, full-blood Thais never have any hair color other than black. Okay, so if they have hair color that isn't black, they're not full blood. My son is not full blood Thai, and he's got sandy brown hair. Okay, but his facial features are Thai. So maybe all of these various facial features and other characteristics that we see around the planet, could that be tied to humans, if you will, from other civilizations out there in the universe, sending colonies here, still basically genetically the same, but they've got a little bit different characteristics being from other parts of the universe.
Well, certainly we know the red race or the Native Americans, now more or less we know that they claim to be from somewhere else. If the Orientals are indeed from somewhere else, that wouldn't surprise me. You know, there's so much we don't know, Kevin. You know that slowly I think all this information will come out, but it's going to take a while. And the sooner we start interacting with the ETs for real, and we can expand our consciousness to that point, the sooner we'll know our history. You know, you do know that the people on Serpo gave us a book called The Yellow Book.
Yes.
And supposedly that's a complete history of planet Earth. But it's difficult to read.
I would say that the sooner we discover our history, the sooner we reestablish contact. Now, the reason for that is, let's say you are a 140-story building. Let's say you are the 140th floor of a 140-story building, and somebody comes along and whacks out two floors. Well, you were the 140th. Now you're the 138th.
Right, exactly.
So, as revisionists have whacked out big sections of our history, our building has grown shorter. Now, you know, the 140th floor stands upon every preceding floor. And huge chunks of this building have been whacked out. And so, you know, we're probably standing at about the 40th floor now.
Right,
so,
exactly.
If
we
could...
we had people like Charles Darwin who came along to really complicate the situation. And that didn't help.
Much at all. Hey, listen, Lynn, I want to thank you for being with us. We're out of time. We're racing toward the end of the show here. I want to thank you for being with us. Where can people get your book?
Go to my website, www.et-secrethistory.com, and they can then click through and buy the book either from the publisher, from Amazon, or from Barnes & Noble, whatever. It's all out there. All the information is out on the website.
Okay, stay on the line with me for just a moment. All right, ladies and gentlemen, that's it for this evening, and I thank you for being here with us. Lynn Kasten, K-A-S-T-E-N, Lynn Kasten. You want to check out the book, The Secret History of Extraterrestrials. The Secret History of Extraterrestrials. Very interesting read, 312 pages, and yet it is it's a pretty fast read. I think you'll enjoy it. My friends call me Steel Eye. My enemies do too, and you can call me whatever you want to call me. Just keep coming back again and again and again. Until next time, so long, everybody.